This is The Guardian.
After more than a week of violent disorder across the country and two Cobra meetings, the Prime Minister insists he's getting a grip on it.
To anybody involved, either directly or online, nobody but nobody should be involving themselves in this disorder.
But for those on the sharp end of what look increasingly like racially motivated attacks, it's been a terrifying few days.
This really changed my mind right now, and I don't think I'm going to continue living here again.
With communities fearful and further protests threatened, is the government's strategy working? I'm Gabby Hinsliff, in for John Harris, and you're listening to Politics Weekly UK for The Guardian. Joining me today from a busy Westminster office is The Guardian's deputy political editor, Jess Elgott. Hello, Jess.
Hello there.
We're recording this on Wednesday morning, nearly 10 days into an outbreak of violent protests, which started after the murder of three little girls in Southport. Keir Starmer's insisted throughout this is just a law and order issue, that it's thuggery rather than political protest.
Whatever the apparent motivation, this is not protest. It is pure violence, and we will not tolerate attacks on mosques or our Muslim communities.
Jess, this has been an early test, really, of authority, the new government's authority. How do you think he's handled this? Are Labour MPs broadly happy with the way it's been dealt with?
You would think that this, if there was going to be a very early crisis in Keir Starmer's term as Prime Minister, that this would be the kind of one he was the most well-equipped to handle. Obviously, he was DPP during the 2011 riots, famously a very harsh response to those riots from prosecutors and from judges. So, you know, if there was going to be anything that he, you know, was experienced and equipped to deal with, then it would be something like this. But the additional element of this being far-right violence, obviously racist, Islamophobic violence, has added a different dimension to it than the one I think that Keir Starmer is inclined to treat it as, which is that this is purely criminal. I think for a lot of MPs and for communities and people who are very fearful about, you know, these attacks, which have seemed to come to sort of spring up in quite difficult to predict places, that doesn't feel like enough now that we've seen this kind of ongoing attacks on mosques, on the businesses owned by people of colour, and that it feels like actually the government should start speaking more broadly about the problems of racism in this country.
Do you see any signs of policy shifting, either on, you know, things like the law around incitement? We've seen Peter Kyle suggesting the current legislation looks, I think, a bit leaky were the words he used. Either that or on asylum policy. We've seen The Times reporting this week that the government will seek to disperse asylum seekers more widely around the country rather than holding them all in hotels that become sort of targets for protest. Do you see any actual policy moves at the moment, or is that still some way off?
I think both of those things are kind of long running policy issues for which this is a kind of example of why the current system isn't working. So, for example, if we're talking about social media companies, there's obviously already laws against criminal content being spread online. But I think there's a broad acceptance that that doesn't cover enough of what we're seeing happening spread on social media. You would think that the government might start to come down on the harsher end of things, of what is allowed, which are sort of permissible to be spread online. You know, having seen the consequences of the way that misinformation took hold, you know, within, you know, just a few hours of those horrific attacks in Southport. And I think also there is a broader point that I think, you know, Labour MPs were actually already starting to make in the chamber even before all of this erupted, that holding asylum seekers effectively indefinitely in hotels in city centres was just not a desirable outcome for anyone. The problem with the other option, of course, is that if there is a preference to put people in smaller accommodations, houses of multiple occupancies, sort of smaller hotels, bed and breakfasts, or, you know, ex-student accommodation, then that takes that out of an already very pressurised housing and rental market. And so you create potentially another problem when you're trying to solve one.
So there's no ideal solutions. Just coming back to what we were discussing earlier about whether we should be more explicitly deeming this racist or Islamophobic violence, let's just hear what the Labour MP Zahra Sultana had to say earlier this week.
I think the Labour Party needs to be stronger in what it is
calling for. I'm glad that there's been progress in calling it Islamophobic. It took us a long time to get to that point when Muslim communities are the communities that are being targeted, as well as black and brown people, asylum seekers who are where arsonists are trying to burn them alive in their hotels. We have to see how the debate around immigration, which has dehumanized people, has led us to this point where people are being, well, hotels are being burned.
Meanwhile, the former Metropolitan Police counter-terrorism officer, Neil Basu, has said that some of the violence fits the legal definition of terrorism, violent acts perpetrated against a section of the population to intimidate or terrorise them in the name of a sort of broader political cause. Is there a reason you think that Starmer is resisting those terms, Jess?
I think that obviously he's got a difficult balance to strike, hasn't he? Which is between kind of giving credibility to a political cause. You know, for terrorism, often that it's a difficult thing to define in law and it's quite narrow. But, you know, that the idea that there is a kind of broader, greater cause behind some of this mindless violence, I think that he is quite reticent to give it that almost credibility, which doesn't feel like quite the right word. But
it suggests it's sort of intellectually coherent, doesn't it?
That's right. The thing, right. But that, I think there is certainly a difference between people who have kind of been in the pub and see the kind of action, as they might see it, happening, and decide to join in and shove a wheelie bin towards police officers, as has been the defence that lots of these people are already using in court. You know, they're not saying, I felt a very strong political cause. They're saying, I was very drunk and I wasn't involved initially, but I got involved because, you know, I wasn't thinking. And that's the defence that lots of people are relying on in court. Whereas I think that there are, you know, potentially an argument to say that there are people who are organising this disruption, this violence, who are coordinating them on social media, including lots of kind of closed messaging apps, whether that's WhatsApp, whether that's Telegram, and arguably could more serious charges be brought against those people. I think that that's a question that the prosecutors will have to grapple with and judges.
It feels to me like what both government and police are struggling with to some extent is that there's lots of different things going on at once. I mean, on the one level, you've got people, you know, smashing the windows of the Lush shop in Hull and stealing bath bombs. I mean, no one's saying that's a political act. And on the other hand, you've got something that seems more orchestrated and seems more ideological and seems very targeted, particularly on asylum, on, you know, asylum seeker hostels, on immigration lawyers, on immigration advice centres. You know, there is a very clear targeting. But the other controversy that government's had to deal with this week has been over claims of two-tier policing, or the idea that many people probably remember Suella Braverman flirting with as Home Secretary not long before she was sacked, which was that the idea that police go easier on left-wing or ethnic minority protesters, supposedly, than they do on the far right. We'll talk about that later in more detail, but the ex-owner Elon Musk has weighed in directly on this one, calling the Prime Minister two-tier Keir, you know, trolling him actively. How has Starmer responded to that? Because it's quite hard to respond with any dignity to that kind of attack, but it's quite dangerous to leave it alone in some ways, isn't it?
There's a distinction, which I think that government are trying to navigate, which is that when Musk said civil war is inevitable as a comment underneath some of the violence, which was in Liverpool, which was posted on X, obviously the government wants to counter that. They want to dial down that kind of rhetoric. So the Starmer spokesman said to journalists on Monday that those comments weren't justified and hit back, you know, in a way that the government doesn't always do when it engages with criticism from public figures. I think as an acknowledgement that Musk obviously has huge influence. He can influence not through just what he says, but also what he promotes on his own platform and how much that is seen by people. But they seem to have, in the last sort of 24 to 48 hours, decided to duck out of getting involved in any kind of personal insults that he might decide to hurl at the Prime Minister, this two-tier Keir talking point. And actually, we reported yesterday that Chief Whip Alan Campbell has actually sent a memo round to Labour MPs telling them that they should not get into kind of debates online about this violence. You know, it wasn't a matter for debate, he says. It's just a matter of law and order. And, you know, that they should all just be using their social media to kind of amplify calls for unity, the positive things they're seeing on in their communities rather than getting into these kind of rows, particularly with right-wing figures.
It seems to be very important to the far right to sort of spread the idea that this is some kind of vast popular uprising or a civil war or, you know, kind of a mass movement. But looking at the evidence on where the public stands on this, there's very little evidence for that. And YouGov had a poll out this week showing 67% of the public thought the rioters were thugs, 58% thought they were racists, 49% thought they should face harsher penalties than would be normal for this kind of crime. So there's not much evidence there for the idea of a widely supported popular uprising. But they also found 49% thought Starmer was handling the riots badly. That's not a huge surprise given that he hasn't been able to stop the riots, and that's probably most people's definition of handling them well. But Jess, do you think Number 10 are starting to feel that pressure from the public?
I think there are definitely legitimate questions about the handling of it when it comes to what you just referenced, Gabby, which was, why hasn't the government been able to stop this from happening? Is there a police intelligence failure in that they just are, you know, unable to sort of arrest whoever are the sort of ringleaders, coordinators of some of the things that are happening and just simply kind of stop them from being organised? I think, bluntly speaking, what Keir Starmer really needs more than anything is for us to return to the rainy summer we were having a few weeks ago to discourage people from going out on the streets. And I think also one of the things that the government is hoping is that as all of these arrests start to sort of make bigger headlines, trickle through the system, we see kind of hundreds of people being remanded in custody potentially, although how the prisons, which we're told are overflowing, are going to hold them is another question. But beyond that, it's hard to see what the strategy is. I'm not sure what the next step is, really.
It does feel a bit as if Pandora's box has been opened and it's not quite going to be possible just to sort of tamp down the lid and hope it doesn't happen again. That said, I mean, we have also just had a very big test of public opinion at last month's election, resulting in a Labour landslide, although I'm sure both of us met Labour candidates who'd had difficult conversations about immigration on the doorstep, and that election also saw a surge for reform that didn't translate into as many seats in Parliament as reform voters perhaps expected. Do you think that's got anything to do with what we're seeing now? Is it a coincidence that all of this has erupted a month after that election in which reform did so well? Or do you think that's changed something about the political temperature?
I do think that there is probably some connection to that. Obviously, it's not a direct connection because obviously I don't think these protests are people consciously thinking we're protesting the arrival of a new Labour government, or we're protesting what we believe will be a change in migration policy. I don't think it's as coherent as that. But of course, what we did see during the election was not just reform, but the Conservative Party whipping up a lot of this kind of ill feeling towards migrants. And, you know, the Conservative Party itself put out social media videos of Labour putting out a red carpet on the beaches in Dover for Channel migrants coming over on boats. Whether that, you know, kind of heightening of the debate around small boat crossings and around migrant hotels where people have been unable to be moved on from them because of the Illegal Migration Act, which makes it impossible for anyone to go through the asylum system, then of course all of that atmosphere is contributing to what we're seeing.
And of course, all of this is happening in the middle of a Tory leadership contest where candidates are going to be at least in part defined by how they respond, whether this is the moment where they sort of disown the rioters and choose this moment to break definitively with Nigel Farage or whether they don't. Jess, four of the candidates, you know, Robert Jenrick, Priti Patel, Tom Tugendhat, James Cleverly, they've all served in the Home Office. They've all had a hand in law and order policy over the last few years. Can you give us a brief rundown on how they've responded and what that tells us? Because it feels to me like Tory MPs were sort of starting to pretty rapidly reassess their relationship with Farage even before the riots, when they saw how much damage reform had done to them during the election. Do you think, in a sense, he's made himself a bit too hot to handle?
Well, I think that there was already quite a clear distinction between those who said that Nigel Farage had no place in the Conservative Party and wouldn't be allowed back in, and that there was no possibility of a merger with Reform, and those who said actually what the Conservatives should be doing is to seek an alliance with Reform. That's what Suella Braverman said. Interestingly enough, she's the one who kind of didn't make it onto the ballot paper. I think Priti Patel's response to some of this has been one of the most interesting. She's been very firm on the idea that there is not two-tier policing. She came out on Times Radio on Monday morning saying that the Black Lives Matter protests were nothing like this. They were not burning things down. They were not attacking people because of the colour of their skin. And she wanted to draw a particular distinction about that. She's been very clear about the idea that, you know, Farage shouldn't be let into the party. She's often seen as the kind of on the very right of the Tory party. And I think she's obviously trying to navigate how to respond to these riots. And Farage, I think, has made himself toxic to quite a lot of the candidates. And I think we should remember to the Tory membership as well. Farage has always been a reasonably, if you look at the polling, popular figure within the Tory membership. But I do think what the Tory membership, which your average Tory member is not going to like, is kind of organised violence on the street. No Tory candidate wants to be anywhere near offering justifications for those kind of scenes.
Maybe every cloud has some kind of silver lining if it means the Conservative Party finally distance itself from Nigel Farage. Jess, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Welcome back. And I'm now joined from Manchester by Nazir Afzal, who was a chief prosecutor in the northwest of England at the same time as Starmer was director of public prosecutions. Nazir, hello.
Hello, Gary.
And thank you for joining us. This has been, a frightening week for a lot of people, seeing this kind of disorder night after night, not seeming to stop. How have you felt about the violence we've seen?
I've had several days where dozens of people have randomly been messaging me and contacting me, many of them from minority communities, many of them Muslims, scared, fearful, wanting reassurance, telling me they've changed their plans, that saying they won't be able to go to this, that and the other because they're scared about what might happen. It's really, really painful because it reminds, so reminiscent of days gone by when we thought this kind of behaviour was something from the past. So I've been doing my best to reassure. We'll get through it, but it's been hard and it still is hard for a lot of people.
Yeah. Are you surprised by what you've seen, or is this something we could potentially have seen coming? I mean, there have been repeated warnings about the rise of far-right extremism, about the police increasingly having to deal with kind of radicalised far-right as well as with other forms of terrorism. Mm. Is it a surprise?
No, of course I'm not surprised. Some of the hostility has been generated by people who should know better. We've had years and years of hostile environment, years and years of dehumanizing language, and that undoubtedly plays on the minds of people who are concerned about lack of housing or the kinds of issues that, you know, we're all concerned about. They all look for somebody to blame, and there have been people out there who've been giving them somebody to blame. You know, historically, August has been the month where you have these kinds of disorder. The sun's out, generally. School's out. Football's out. So it's timing-wise, again, no surprise.
Yeah, talking of school being out, one of the things that's been really startling is the number of quite young kids that we've seen getting caught up in the violence. You obviously were at the CPS during the August 2011 riots. The government's sort of attempt this time to ensure that people accused of public order offences are processed very swiftly. It looks like a repeat of the 2011 tactics, trying to show people who attempted to kind of join in or get swept up in it that there are consequences. Is that working, do you think? Have we given it enough time to work?
It worked in 2011, and that's why, you know, the protocol was created on the back of 2011. 2011 had lots of different things happening, one of which was there were a lot more people involved. It may seem like this is bad. It was actually worse in 2011. there were thousands of people involved in disorder up and down the country and often in very random places. There was a logistical reason why we needed to open the course 24/7, because the police cells were full, police vans were full. There was nowhere to put anybody. Mm. Well, we don't necessarily have the same that same issue this time. But, you know, if it worked once, I hope the feeling must be that it will work this time.
Starmer was your boss at the time. Mm. How do you think he's going to be feeling faced with this again? What do you think his instincts are going to be?
The same instincts he had in 2011, which was robust policing, prosecution and justice, accountability, reassurance to manage, helping people manage the fear, everybody treating this as the emergency that it is, and working together multi-agency. That's what he did. That's what we did in 2011. And I've no doubt that's the instinct that he will have now.
Except that this time he's got the added responsibilities of political leadership and reassurance and managing community tensions and so on. The longer this goes on, I mean, there's an obvious risk that if the riots continue night after night, that you have increasing urges for people, you know, the communities are increasingly tempted to sort of take the law into their own hands, to seek to defend themselves as they'd see it. We've seen some evidence of that, perhaps in Birmingham over the last couple of days. Are you worried about a risk of vigilante action in response to some of this?
Well, of course I'm worried. I'm worried. People have been showing enormous restraint from the communities under attack, to put it bluntly, in the last few days. And community leaders, for want of a better term, have been very active in providing reassurance, ensuring that people feel secure, but also, you know, reminding them that, you know, we need to comply with the law and let the law deal with those who are committing crimes. But how long that can last, well, you know, that will depend upon a number of factors, one of which, of course, is how long this goes on. But the other one is when people just are so frustrated and so fearful that they think the only response must be to take some action themselves. I'm hoping we never get to that.
Let's hope we don't have to wait that long. I mean, there have been some complaints over the last few days. Protesters certainly are complaining about what they call two-tier policing, or the suggestion that police go easier on left-wing protesters or on ethnic minority protesters than they do on the far right. It's obviously quite an incendiary claim to make. From what you've seen, is that fair? I mean, police are inevitably going to use slightly different tactics depending on the level of threat or the cause of protest or who exactly it is they're dealing with. Is that quite a difficult thing to explain to the public at large?
Yeah, I'm sure it is difficult to explain. And that's why I think there needs to be much more more of a narrative around there, more conversations about it, be more transparent about it. If you have hundreds of thousands of people on the street, as we've had, for example, in demonstrations over the last few months, then heavy-handed policing is not the appropriate thing. If violence takes place, if there's hateful content, you get involved. But generally, you stand back. These people have told the police that they're having a demonstration. You know, they've complied with the protest regulations.
You're thinking of here are things like the Palestine marches.
Yeah, exactly that. So, you know, there's a way you police that, and that's almost it is policing by consent. When you have people who are just turning up mob-handed, armed with 24 cans of cider and sticks and bones and sticks and you name it, then you have a different level of policing. You know, I can tell you, when people talk about two-tier policing, Gabby, you forget that black people are nine times more likely to be stopped and searched. You forget that a black man is more likely to be arrested, convicted, sentenced to prison on the same evidence as a white man. You forget that 98% of women who report rape will never have anybody charged. Two-tier policing takes place in a number of areas. It's not just about white neo-Nazis in some case. So I think we need to make it clear. You're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. And the police are having to do as much as they possibly can to reassure people. But at the same time, I would welcome them speaking more frequently about what they're doing.
Yeah, you know, about the complexity.
They need to have a great... I'm sure they're doing it on a local basis, but I think nationally we need to see more of them talking about these issues.
Yvette Cooper, the Home Secretary, has said that we have to tackle what she calls armchair thuggery, or people inciting violence online but not necessarily directly perpetrating it themselves. There's been concern over the social media activity of a number of individuals, particularly people like Tommy Robinson, former head of the EDL, as well as some of Nigel Farage's public statements. How difficult is it to prosecute incitement to violence? I mean, there is a fine line there between free speech and exercising your right to free speech, however abhorrent the things you might want to say, and actively encouraging violence. Do you think it's clear enough, or do you think police have, or do you think there are powers to prosecute the kind of thing that we're seeing, which strays very close to the line, perhaps?
No, I mean, policing of protests is not that, it's not a new thing. We've been doing it for as long as I've been alive, and so I'm not overly concerned. Policing, as part of their basic training, so their first 18 weeks will have riot training and you know what to do in relation to those you might arrest and detain, and how you might charge them. So it's a pretty entrenched piece of work which police officers understand. The wider public need to understand it. One of the things I've been doing over the last few
years. But
there's
a newer challenge there, isn't there? I mean, as you say, we've been policing protests for decades, God knows how long. But what Cooper has been talking about is more of an online phenomenon than a sort of real life phenomenon. And that's a relatively new thing, dealing with the way in which social media can be used to incite violence.
This is the difference. We are seeing people inciting riots and inciting violence. We are people who are radicalizing, put it bluntly, people to commit these types of crimes and these types of behaviors. And that's why this time, I hope this is going to happen, that the police prosecutors will be focusing on those people who are the keyboard warriors, that they are brought to justice, whomever they may be and whatever role they may have in life. There are strict rules about what you can and can't say or do. I don't get what Elon Musk says about freedom of speech. We've never had freedom of speech that allows violence being proposed. We've never had freedom of speech that allows hate speech to be an exemption, so to speak. The law is clear on this. We've already had, I think, prosecutions for inciting racial hatred using Facebook, and we will have many, many more. I can assure you, Gabby, that there will be dozens and dozens of people who think that by deleting their online presence, they're safe. Unfortunately, this is where policing has got better over the last decade, is that police have been downloading this stuff in real time from the beginning. They have special teams that do that kind of work, and they will actively be investigating this now. And there's no time limit to these crimes, so if you don't get a knock on the door in the next day or two, don't worry, they'll be coming.
Alongside maliciously linking immigrants to terrorism and crime, some of the protesters have been talking about grooming gangs, evidently something they're also keen to smear all Asian men with. You prosecuted grooming gangs at the CPS. How do we begin to unwind these very toxic associations, the idea that Muslim men specifically are somehow a threat to women and girls?
Well, for a decade or more, we've had a government that has done the opposite. The former Home Secretary's several Home Secretaries in the last few years have been actually playing to that audience, haven't they? We need to have a conversation about sexual abuse. Absolutely. We need to have a conversation about child sexual abuse. Absolutely. But we need to contextualize it. 84% of sex offenders in this country are British white men. Two-thirds of all sexual abuse of children happens in the family. So, we need to have that conversation. But, it does not justify the behavior. I remember when I did Rochdale, the BNP wanted to have a chat with me and their solicitors, and I reached out to them. And they strangely stopped talking when I mentioned the fact that I just prosecuted another BNP member for his sexual abuse of children. And their response was, well, he's no longer a member. Well, yeah, all right. He's no longer a member. But I can't say that about Muslims who might have been involved in this behavior. At the end of the day, Gabby, criminality begins and ends with a criminal. 99.9% of all community members in all communities are law-abiding. We need to ensure that those who aren't are brought to justice, and that is happening. I don't think there's enough being said about the number of people that have been brought to justice, and that, I think, is a conversation. That's what I think we could do, which will give some reassurance to the wider public that this is not a subject that's being hidden and not a subject that's not being taken seriously.
As a woman, I certainly always find it very telling when people only want to discuss gender-related violence perpetrated by one group of men and not by men generally, put it that way.
Yeah, that's the point. If by focusing on the ethnicity, you're forgetting about the victim.
Once the violence is over, hopefully that's soon, do you think there's a bigger conversation to be had about some of the root causes that we've been talking here? It's going to be, it's Absolutely. Been quite hard to draw a line under this and just move on, isn't it?
The misinformation has to be countered, not by just simply saying it's misinformation, but by providing and educating. Educating, you know, talk to people about the benefits of migration to this country. You know, the reality is that the presence of immigrants is not the reason why you can't get an NHS appointment. In fact, the presence of immigrants is why you can get an NHS appointment. A more positive case being made around immigration and migration generally, dealing with the massive backlogs that we have now in asylum seeker applications being the process. All of that has to happen. We have to have a conversation about migration. But the reason why we don't have enough housing isn't because of migrants, it's because we haven't built enough houses. The reason why the NHS is struggling isn't because of migrants, it's because the NHS is struggling for all sorts of other reasons. So, yes, but it's got to be an informed conversation, Gabby, not one that just simply focuses on migrants as being a threat, but actually the positivity that migrants and people of colour bring to this country and have done for decades now.
Informed conversation is what we're here to have. So thank you so much, Nazir, for helping us to have one. Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. If you did, make sure you subscribe to Politics Weekly UK, wherever you get your podcasts. Meanwhile, if you're interested in American politics, please go and listen to our sister podcast, Politics Weekly America, where Johnny Friedland is talking to Molly Jong-Fast, special correspondent for Vanity Fair, about Kamala Harris's pick for running mate, Governor Tim Walz. Find that wherever you get your podcasts. This episode was produced by Frankie Toby, music by Axel Cacoutier, and the executive producers are Maz Ebtahaj and Nicole Jackson.
This is The Guardian.